Thank you. So ADS-CFT duality is an amazing thing. It teaches us all these new things about gauge theories. It even allows us to model real-world systems like heavy ions and maybe exotic phases in condensed matter. And these are just its hobbies, because its real job is to provide a non-perturbative construction of quantum gravity, which it does because, in principle, we have a non-perturbative construction of the dual field theory. Now, it's a pretty special construction, because it constructs the theory in this anti-de Sitter box, something like the soup can one always draws, and it describes observations made by observers sort of on the walls of the box, who can sort of throw stuff in and watch stuff come out. But this already, you know, tells us a lot. There's a lot that can be happening inside this box. Black holes can form and decay. And one of the most immediate things that one learns from this is that since the observations of the observer are described by quantum mechanics, ordinary quantum mechanics, one learns that black hole evolution is unitary, that it doesn't violate ordinary quantum mechanical evolution. So it tells us that in some sense Hawking was wrong, although in a deeper sense he was right, because it was his paradox that very much, I think, led to even the discovery of this duality. Now the question is, so this is clearly a deep clue as to how to formulate quantum gravity, but the question is, you know, how to take the lessons from this very special space-time and apply them to space-times like our own, where we don't have these convenient walls to formulate things on. And, you know, this is, well, probably been sitting there since you know, the beginning of this, and it's not even clear what the right framework is. So what I'd like to talk about is you know, various ways to think about what's happening in the interior, the bulk space-time, from the point of view of the quantum field theory, the dual quantum field theory. You know, in retrospect, one can understand why this works, why things work so nicely in this special geometry. In quantum gravity, it's really very hard to formulate physical observables. As C always reminds us, the way you all made progress in gauge theory was only to calculate things that are physically observable and not off-shell things. And in gravity, you know, a physical observable, you sort of have to say where something is, but the space-time metric is fluctuating, and so you need to implicitly in some way construct a system of clocks and rods. And so real physical observables in general in quantum gravity are very complicated. This is kind of the one situation where there are simple observables, and that's because of the geometry, because of the warping, the quantum fluctuations of the metric damp down as you approach the boundary, and so you have a place that you can stand and make well-defined observations, even though not far away, the metric is all going wild and whatever quantum gravity can do, it does. It's interesting, you know, to even think about what the target is beyond ADS-CFT. You know, what would be an answer to the question, what is quantum gravity, because what are the observables? So, for example, in Juan's talk on Monday, in a cosmological setting, the one sort of place to look for nice observables is in the far future. The asymptotic behaviors of things, and then only in special states where the far future, you know, space-time is fairly well behaved. But that's sort of the one you know, answer that suggests itself for cosmology. But what I want to do is sort of think. What I want to focus on in this talk is again think about reconstructing how one reconstructs the interior from the conformal field theory in various ways. Some of them sort of finished, and some of them just starting. So let me draw a piece of the boundary there. And so this is where the conformal field theory sort of lives, and then there's the interior. And one way to think about one thing that's remarkable about this is that you can have two excitations that are far apart in the interior, and therefore they shouldn't be, they, you know, they should be not interacting with each other strongly. And yet when you project them onto the boundary, it looks like they're sort of in the same place. And so how does one see from the point of view of the small field theory that those are far apart? And a partial answer is given by this idea that energy associated with radius, or throw it this way, you can sort of project each of these onto the boundary using light rays. And so an excitation which is close to the boundary is small in the field theory. An excitation which is far away is large. And so things that are far enough separated will be very different in scale in the small field theory. And there's a sense in which, at least in some cases, physics is fairly local in scale. There are various parts of QCD phenomenology, like color transparency, where things that are very different in size don't interact so strongly. And so this is a partial answer to how you can have local physics in this direction that you don't see. But it's really a very, very incomplete answer. Because if you look at it, so this locality in scales is, you know, in typical quantum field theory is at best an order one thing. So if we call this coordinate, so using z for the usual coordinate, this gives you sort of locality to an accuracy delta z over z is of order one, or in terms of the ADS metric, where L is the ADS radius. This gives us locality over scales, you know, delta S of order L, which is very coarse, because as one takes the Tuff parameter large, the ADS radius is large compared to fixed physical scales like the string scale and the Planck scale, and one thinks that there should be local physics on much shorter scales than this. And so how do we understand that from the point of view of the conformal field theory? This is much greater than the scales we expect to see locality on. Down to. Now, let me formulate more sharply what one means by locality from the point of view of the conformal field theory. And one way to think about it is in terms of a scattering experiment. You can throw in wave packets from the boundary. And if they intersect, then you'll have a large, so you can think of this as a 2-2 scattering process. If they intersect, you'll have a large amplitude. But if you change one of the wave packets by just a little bit so that it misses the other ones, from the point of view of the conformal field theory, it doesn't seem like you've done a whole lot. You've just slightly changed the, you know, whatever it is you're folding into these operators. There's nothing particularly special from the point of view of the conformal field theory, but from the point of view of the bulk, it's clear that the interaction no longer happens, or it's much, much weaker if these packets don't pass through each other. And so there's some kind of sharp peaking in the conformal field theory correlators. So this is a four-point correlator here. Each operator in the CFT creates or destroys a particle. So there's some property of the four-point function which characterizes this locality property. And this was nicely refined by, I'm just going to write initial here because I write badly. So Gary, Giddings, and Penedones, Okuda, and Penedones, and Penedones, nicely refined this packet story into a statement about a singularity of the four-point function. So let me sort of give you a little bit of a flavor of that. So let's start by thinking, this is obviously a Lorentzian process here. But let's think about just the Euclidean four-point function in the conformal field theory, so four operators. And in any number of dimensions, there are two cross ratios for a four-point function conformal field theory. which can be collected into a single complex coordinate. Oops. See, everybody so far this week has been overusing x. I was about to overuse z. I was using it both for my radial coordinate and for my complex plane here. I'm going to use w. So w is the complex cross ratio. And this works in any dimension, but it's very much like just the string world sheet. That is, there are obvious coincidences. So if you ask now, you have again some four-point function. There's obvious singularities when any two of these operators coincide, and the coincidence limits, you know, are conventionally w equals 0, 1, and infinity. So there's three obvious points in the complex plane where the four-point function would be singular because operators are coming together. This is not one of those points. And in fact, if here's 0, here's 1, and infinity somewhere over here. And the Lorentzian kinematics corresponds to z equals z bar, but on a separate, on a different sheet. So if we start with z and z bar, and we continue z around here and z bar around here, where they meet, that's the point that gives you the Lorentzian scattering kinematics. And so the statement is that locality in the bulk implies that the four-point function has a singularity here. And it's actually even weakly coupled Kvaal field theories can have a singularity at this point, but the singularity is stronger when you have local interactions in the bulk of ADS-CFT. In fact, there's a nice formula which has been successfully refined in these papers, which expresses the singularity at this point z equals z bar on this second sheet in terms of a Mellin transform. The residue is a Mellin transform of the flat space. So there's a singularity unit weak coupling. As you take lambda to infinity, take the Tuff coupling to infinity, the singularity becomes stronger. And so the statement is that in the Tuff coupling to infinity limit, where the ADS space is becoming flatter and flatter, the coefficient of the singularity is just a flat space time S matrix. So if you all succeed in using integrability or whatever to calculate the four-point function for all values of the Tuff parameter, then if you take it to infinity, you'll find hiding in it a little copy, you know, of the flat space time S matrix string theory. That's the Bureau-Sorge Pure-Amplitude. Actually, this is not just a statement. This is not just a planar statement. I like to think about, so this is really a non-Tuff, this should really be thought of as a non-Tufftian limit. You want to hold the local physics in the bulk fixed. You want to hold G string fixed. And so you want, so Gn and N go to infinity together. And in that limit, you keep the local physics fixed and you capture the flat space-time S matrix non-perturbatively in G string. Okay.
I guess if you did the planar calculation of a four-point function, you would just get the three-level S matrix.
Exactly. So there's already, that would already be really good. Yeah. Right. Yeah, really good. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, now, think about, of course we all believe ADS-CFT duality, but if you think about the things that count as tests of ADS-CFT duality, this one hasn't ever been tested. I think it's fair to say, most of the tests have to do with the operator spectrum, which is the two-point function, and there's like some protected three-point functions, and there's various special limits like long strings. But I don't think that we ever have had sufficient control of a four-point function in the field theory to say it really has this property that ADS-CFT predicts. So I'd like to describe a partial test of the duality of this feature of the duality. And sticking with initials, this is work with Heemskerk, Penedones again, me, and Sully. So even to talk about this locality, again, one needs that there's a hierarchy of scales, that the ADS scale becomes large compared to the Planck and string scales, where it's less clear what locality means. And so LADS much larger than L Planck means that N is going to large, and L much greater than L string means the Tuck parameter is becoming large. And so these are necessary conditions to have this bulk locality, at least in any normal physical sense. Actually, this one has a second implication, because if you think about the spectrum of dimensions of operators, you got the usual delta, delta minus 4 is m squared, l squared. And now there's a certain number of supergravity excitations, Klutz-Klein modes on the phi sphere whose mass is of order 1 over l squared. Klutz-Klein excitations. But for the string excitations, this is of order l, 1 over l string squared. And so this grows as root lambda for the much larger number of operators. And so one of the corollaries of these is that there is this hierarchy developing in the spectrum of operator dimensions. And that's very unusual. It's actually very hard. I don't know of any I don't have any toy models where models that we don't solve. It's not models in which we don't just get the answer from that. I don't have any models in which we can directly see this hierarchy of dimensions forming like this. I mean, maybe for some long string states, but it's a very special property, and it's especially special that one. It's plausible to conjecture that while these conditions are necessary, that these once in this form, that they're actually sufficient. That a conformal field theory that has this hierarchy of dimensions, as well as a large N expansion, would satisfy this property and would have local physics in the bulk. And so I can describe some partial results along those lines, and then I'll talk about maybe better ways to think about these things. So
so can I ask a question?
Please, of course. Yeah.
Is this just ADS 5 times this 5, or is this any ADS?
So, well, I'm always thinking about that as the most characteristic example, but this would be this.
I'm asking about the flat space time limit.
The idea is general there. That is, I mean, in any realization of ADS-CFT, local operators in the boundary will create some one particle states in the bulk, and this construction will give the S matrix for those particles. So that part is completely general.
Yeah. Flat space time doesn't depend on the S5, the substitution for the S5.
Or? Well, the S5 gets big too. So what's interesting is that you could use, this is one of the funny things about ADS-CFT duality is that. You could start with either of the different two V realizations. You could start with ADS 5 cross S5 or ADS 3 cross S3 cross T4 or even something less symmetric. But they should all, and although they're very different as quantum field theories, if the duality is right, they have to all give you the same flat space limit. So there's a common thing to all ADS-CFT dualities, which is certainly not manifest in the way that that they appear. Right, right. So, so the simplest thing to think about, since this is a question about the four-point function, is the four-point function of four scalar operators. And whenever I have a curly O, I mean some general single trace operator, like the trace of F mu nu, single trace scalar operator F mu nu, maybe some scalars in there, whatever. And later on, I'll be talking several times about multi-trace operators. O is always single trace, and so O squared and so on would be double trace. Okay, and what do we what levers do we have to study this? We have not a lot. We have the OPE, and we have crossing. And again, the one thing that we're adding to the usual formalism is the assumption that the specific formal assumption is that there's a finite number of single trace operators that appear, or finite number of single trace primaries. That can include things like the Ng-Mentham tensor, so that even though we don't have gravitons on the external legs, they can be exchanged in the interior. There's also, again, there's any number of, so there's always going to be a very large number of, an arbitrary large number of multi-trace operators, double-trace operators, whose dimensions don't get large. And so what appears in the OPE is a finite number of single-trace operators plus the multi-trace operators that you construct out of them. And so this is with this extra assumption, there is actually enough leverage to be able to solve the crossing relation. And the main result is that, to leading order 1 over n squared, leading connected 1 over n squared. And the result is that the solutions are in one-to-one correspondence. Solutions of the crossing relation with local interactions in the bulk. So phi fourth, phi squared, partial phi, and so on. So this is a different. This is actually a sort of a more simple criterion for locality. It's not. We're not looking directly at that singularity. Talking about just saying, as a practical matter, every solution to crossing can be obtained via the ADS-CFT duality from some bulk calculation with a local bulk Lagrangian. So it's local in that sense. And there's a couple of things I need to say about what this means before I go on. Just to very briefly describe one feature of the how the solution is done. I'm not going to go through it. There's been this interesting work by Rattazzi and collaborators on getting sort of bounds on operator dimensions from crossing and the OPE. And at least in their initial work, I don't know if they've gone past this. What they found most useful was to take sort of the midpoint z equals a half and study the crossing relations at that point, because that's kind of a fixed point of one of the crossing relations. For us, it was most useful to take again z and z bar and to continue them separately, 1 to 0 and 1 to 1. So one can analytically continue independently, and this seemed to be the sort of most fruitful place for reducing the crossing relations to a sort of recursion-like form. I mention this because Juan pointed out that if you ask, so I told you what the scattering process looks like in terms of the complex plane. Juan pointed out that this particular point looks like the following. Your four points are all light-like related to each other around the ADS, which is, I know, a kinematic configuration that has come up a lot recently in discussions of gauge theories. And again, this is not a Wilson line. These are local operators. But I don't know if there's any connection between sort of why this was a useful thing for us and why this is interesting for other reasons. But just a comment. Now. Now, as to what this means, so I tell you it's local in this sense, but of course, whenever you have an infinite number of local interactions, then you say, well, can I sum them up and make something non-local? Well, first, two comments. Already, this tells you that things are analytic in momentum. There aren't solutions which are non-analytic in momentum, which would be truly non-local. But actually, there's more than that, because the crossing relations actually tell you that if you sum these up, the sum has to converge sufficiently rapidly as to have zero range. So if you by zero range, I mean if you put in a part, if you induce these by exchange of a massive particle, you'd get obviously a certain series of local interactions, and this sum has to follow more rapidly than any finite mass particle would produce. So it really is local in some meaningful sense, even though there's an infinite number of local interactions. Which is, there's another sense in which locality could break down, even given what I said, which is not in the sum, but if we talk about the coefficients of individual operators, if we compare this operator with this operator, we need a 1 over some length squared. I'm sorry, we need a length squared here. Well, here we need a length squared here to make the units the same as in this operator. And one, by locality, we would mean that as we take, again, lambda to infinity, this number remains fixed in physical units, in units of the string or Planck length, and that doesn't grow with the ADS radius. And so far, there's nothing. In order to argue that, one has to go to the next order in 1 over n squared and argue that the planar expansion breaks down if this coefficient grows too rapidly. And I believe that's true, and things get much messier the next one we're over n squared, so I don't think we have a sharp argument. So there was a group, Fitzpatrick, Katz, Simmons, Duffin, I forget, sorry, I'm missing a name, Pullen. That analyzes from sort of a different point of view, and indeed argued that convergence to the planar expansion put an upper bound on this coefficient. Now, I'm a bit confused. Actually, Juan raised this yesterday, whether one really knows that this coefficient stays fixed in physical units or whether it might grow at some rate in between the ADS and fixed physical scales. I believe that it has to stay fixed in physical units. There may be issues of powers of L Planck over L string, but not of L. I don't believe there are issues of L ADS over L.
Right. But I think the argument doesn't show what one wants to like to show, right? I think there's an n multiplying everything, which is like g-string.
Right, right.
And then one wants to show that this is down by epsilon. This is an expansion in the string length. It's another length scale.
Right, right. There is this issue, can you encounter scales that are longer than the string length by powers of g-string? Right, they'd still be physical lengths, but they would be longer than the string length.
If it was a string theory, yeah, you would get the string length there.
That's right.
That's what sets the hierarchy of these operator dimensions. And this hierarchy is completely independent of n.
I think I agree. I think it's not as strong as you expect, but it's still fixed in physical units. It doesn't grow with the ADS length. So I just wanted to make that There's issues of basically the argument here is a transposition is just a translation into conformal field theory of the usual effective field theory argument about sizes of operators. And even in effective field theory, there's always this issue of where you put the alphas. You know, how do you count alphas in effective, so I think it's the same issue coming up again. Okay, so by the way, there's an old intuition that goes back to the early days of ADS-CFT that this thing that we're talking about, that having local physics at scales less than the ADS radius, has to do with the detailed structure of the matrices. Roughly speaking, if you count states, the states in a single ADS volume are roughly in correspondence with the states of a single matrix, not a whole matrix field. And so to see more locally, you have to see inside the matrix. Somehow, okay, this way of thinking about things doesn't use that directly, but I think there's an indirect connection which maybe can be more precise in that I think in all cases we know of that develops the hierarchy of dimensions, there is a matrix structure of some sort in the quantum field theory. For example, there are theories like the n equals 2 theory with n flavors, which doesn't have such a matrix structure because of the flavors, and it also doesn't have this property. So I think there's actually a connection between this statement about the spectrum of anomalous dimensions and the fact that one is dealing with matrices.
So you think it's really the matrices
as opposed to
the intrinsic
percentage of the same point? Yeah, matrices are important, yeah. I think that theory with large number of flavors, it really deserves more thought, but yeah.
I think in the wave packet picture as well, mm-hmm. to really get good follow-up on those wave packets, we found that you might need to really think about heavily that matrix structure.
Also, David Berenstain has been, from sort of a different point of view, trying to quasi-diagonalize the matrices, and again, small objects mapped to sub-matrices. So clearly, this is an additional ingredient. Okay, so now, I think this is nice and suggestive, but I have to say that it's a bit unsatisfying. That is, we were able to solve the crossing relations, but it was kind of luck that it seemed kind of random that we had enough conditions to solve them, because there were redundant conditions, and it was hard to count the number of independent ones, and going to sort of next order and 1 over n squared, maybe somebody would be clever enough to do that, but it seemed like there should be a more physical way to think about this if this is true. Also, this relies very heavily on symmetry, and there are examples of gauge gravity duality with much less symmetry, like the D2 brain theory, which has no scale invariance but still generates a large space-time volume. And then there's questions that you'd like to ask, like about physics near a black hole, where again you the black hole, you've heated up the system, you've broken all the conformal symmetry, and so these very special tools don't really seem like they're going to work. And so if this is a principle, there should be maybe a better way to think about it. And so I'd like to switch over now to a different way to try to organize the question, and that's to study the renormalization group in the conformal field theory. After all, since our basic assumption here is an assumption about the spectrum of operators dimensions, it seems like maybe the natural place to put that information is in the renormalization group. So, so there's sort of a goal. Well, I guess I'm allowed to write an action down, a path integral in this program. I think Steve did in one of his talks. At least it's Lagrangian, so. So I've always thought that the goal was to do something like this, to start with that path integral, and by a change of variables, turn it into this path integral. Now, again, maybe the answer is to find some third thing that descends to both, but or if in the approximation that I've been talking about, in the approximation where one only sees kind of the low dimension operators, it'd be an approximate change of variables in which this is the integral over the supergravity fields. And so what I'd like to think about is actually, and it hasn't succeeded yet, but I want to sort of give a framework for it, is a framework for making this change of variables. And again, not sort of from first principles, but with the added assumption that I've been describing, that this conformal field theory has this limited spectrum of dimensions. And I'm somewhat, so one reason I'm talking about this, even though it hasn't yet succeeded, is that that something similar seems to have succeeded. There's this work by Douglas, Mazzucato, and Razamat, who have basically carried this out for, well, on this side you have a free theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and on this side you have one of Vasiliev's higher spin theories, and basically using the kind of machinery that I'm going to talk about. It's interesting because there was a 91-page paper by Zhambi and Yin that confirmed like a couple of three-point functions. And then Douglas et al. In 4 pages sort of did all amplitudes. So by the standards of your program, that's a modest amount of data compression.
But they did do it in the same theory. They did do it in the same theory.
Right? It's not the same theory. Well, sorry, what sense?
Well, the Douglas et al. Didn't show that the theory they got is the Vasiliev theory. It resembles it.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, I don't fully understand this, and I don't... Right. Okay, good. So you say it's not really...
Yeah, it's not obvious that what Douglas got was the same as the Vasiliev theory, so...
Okay. Well, we'll take moral support. We'll take inspiration from them anyway.
It probably is, but
yeah.
But they got some theory in the ball. They defined a theory in the ball, so I think it's dual theory. Right. Yes. You know, whether it's some known pre-existing theory is.
Yeah. No, that's right. It's not that they simplified the calculation of John Ball.
Oh. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that they hadn't actually reproduced that calculation. So. What I'd like to do is to sort of a schematic Wilsonian path integration. You've got an integral over your gauge fields or whatever, and you break it into the long wavelength part and the short wavelength part. And here is, so now, again, energy, so this is coming back to the idea of associating energy with ADS radius. And so the analogous structure in the bulk is to separate, you have the bulk fields. So phi here will be generic bulk fields, eventually even the metric, but, well, then we have to worry about fixing gauge. Let's just say it's some scalar fields in the bulk. And we can separate them into, again, the infrared region. The interface and the UV region. And I just want to draw some analogies between this separation and this separation. And again, this separates into sort of a UV piece and an IR piece. And the tilde, by the way, is there. So there's an integral over the fields at small z, large z, and over the boundary between them, the interface between them. And so the tilde, it refers to the fields on the interface. And so I want to do the infrared. So let me do the infrared integral and call it psi IR, which still is a function of the fields on the interface. and then psi uv, function of fields on the interface. And I want to sort of draw parallels again between this and that. So it's plausible that for some choice of regulator, that the thing I've called psi ir, which again is this path integral over the infrared end, So the data here, so you have a path integral over the infrared fields, which plausibly corresponds to a path integral in the Kamala field theory with some kind of UV cutoff. And this is an idea that I think was first made explicit, well, a long time ago by Susskind and Witten. They argued that the number of degrees of freedom worked. That the geometric entropy over here matched on to the number of degrees of freedom over here. No one's ever figured out what the cutoff is. And by the way, I'm sorry. This is work with Itza Heemskerk. No one has ever figured out what the cutoff is. But it's plausible. Eventually, maybe we could figure this out, but I'd just like to assume that this is true. Also, of course, there's many operators. But the data is one bulk field for every single trace operator. So whatever the dictionary is, it's something like this, something like what I've written here. And of course, as with many things in the normalization group, if I change the cutoff, it's just a different scheme. And so this is true with any cutoff, it will be true with every cutoff, but with some field redefinition. And there may be one scheme that's much better than the others, but in some ways one doesn't have to know what the scheme is because the structure of the relation is independent to that. Okay. Now, what's the rest? So that's giving an interpretation to this thing. But what's the rest of this? So if we take this and this, and and let me come back to my quantum field theory. After integrating out the UV modes, what's left is what you call the Wilsonian action. And so with this assumption and this definition of what we mean by the Wilsonian action, then what you see is that the Wilsonian action I'm not going to write out the sum over operators. It's just there. And so this thing from the UV end is not directly the Wilsonian action. It's basically the Laplace transform or the Fourier transform of the Fourier transform really of the Wilsonian action. The Wilsonian action is the Fourier transform of it. And that has a consequence, which well is the following. Suppose in the simplest case that we just have free field theory. So this ultraviolet path integral is going to be Gaussian. If this is Gaussian in the field, then after integrating out this field, this will be Gaussian in the operator. So what this means is that even in the simplest case, the action that you induce by this Wilsonian integration has not just the usual kind of single trace terms, but has multi-trace terms as well. Now that was a surprise for a number of reasons. One is that when one does large n limits, one usually thinks of single traces as the norm, and multi-traces as a special thing. that happens in exotic circumstances. But in fact, there are more and more exotic circumstances that seem to come up. And this is what this is saying is that, you know, really that multi-trace actions are, from the RG point of view, the generic thing. And it's surprising for a second reason, because what I'm doing here is some version of what's usually called the holographic renormalization group. And if you look at that literature, in at least 80% of it, it's somehow regarded as a flow just on the space of single trace actions. But I'm emphasizing this now because actually this is going to be useful for this point is going to be important for what I'm going to say basically next. So actually, this assertion that the RG generates multi-trace interactions is something that was already known on the CFT side. I think the first reference I know of is Gao Li, although likely in some form there were earlier ones. But so the Wilson normalization group, you're integrating out scale by scale, so you sort of integrate out the highest momentum propagator first. And so there's these two usual terms. If you integrate or propagate it like this that connects two vertices, then you just truncate that vertex and you make that interaction. If you integrate a propagator that connects two fields in a single vertex, it just leaves you with a single vertex with two fewer fields. But now let's fatten these out into double lines to see the large N structure, the trace structure. So, that's a single trace interaction. If you cap off all of the external propagators, you get one index line. And here, again, a single trace interaction. But there's one more thing I can draw in the planar theory, because these two lines need not be adjacent. So I can also draw this. Okay. And now you see that when you contract these lines, have two index lines, and so now the field theoretic version of the RG also just automatically, even starting from just a single trace interaction, will generate multi-trace interactions. It's not obvious from this, but if you do the N counting, it could make it obvious fairly shortly, but I won't. Not only are these multi-trace interactions generated, but they contribute at leading planar order to various objects. And so this is not simply something that shows up at next order in one of the rest. These contribute to leading planar correlators. But now, okay, so now I simply want to think about starting from the CFT. So I want to ask the question. I give you a CFT. How are you going to somehow get the bulk path integral out of it? How are you going to naturally rewrite this in terms of fields that live in one extra dimension? And so to do that, I simply want to run this logic backwards. Let me first think about the Wilsonian approach, but let me think about doing this integration again in the usual way. You know, in a series of successively smaller momenta, so it becomes a sort of a multiple integral, like the way you build a path integral. And now, if you think about the discussion, the parallel bulk discussion, each of these integrations, even if I start with single trace interactions, is going to generate these multi-trace interactions, and if I want to, I can reduce these back to single trace again by introducing an auxiliary field, the thing I call phi tilde. And so I can start with the convolved field theory and slice it up in momentum space, and because of this term, it's natural to introduce on each slice a phi tilde. And not just scalars, because one of the operators in here is PMU nu. So you also be introducing the metric on these slices. Although to do this, to really make this construction work for the metric, you have to fix gauge somehow. So far, at least, this thing doesn't display the coordinate variant of the bulk in all of its glory. But in this way, the CFT naturally gives rise to a path integral in one higher dimension. And actually, this is very similar to things that Sung-Sik Lee has been saying for a number of years, although using a lattice cutoff. Now there's a problem, and it's the problem. So this is a framework, but it doesn't yet really show us anything. It doesn't allow us to give an alternate derivation of that earlier result, although I think eventually it will. But there's an interesting thing about this, because this what I've described here is manifestly local in this radial coordinate. So in the first discussion, I talked about how this radial coordinate emerges and said, well, but physics is only local approximately in that direction. In the normalization group, things are fully local in scale. And so here's sort of a representation of the theory, which seems to have manifest locality in the radial direction. But the penalty is that because you're dealing here with cutoff field theories, you've lost the locality in the Poincaré directions to a greater extent than you'd like. If you ask there's some effective action, there's now some effective bulk action. It's not very symmetric, but there's some effective bulk action here. The bulk action is non-local on the ADS scale in the Poincaré directions. It's not non-local on these shorter physical scales. But we haven't yet put in our assumption about the spectrum of operator dimensions. And we haven't figured out how to incorporate this in an efficient way. It's hidden in there somehow. So take this structure and throw in the extra assumption about the operator dimensions, and I believe that one should be able to conclude that you really have a local action in the bulk, though we haven't finished this yet. Okay. So So one final comment about the Wilson RG, which is, okay, the Wilson RG is great. In the sense that if you are forced to define a quantum field theory, the Wilson RG is the deltas and epsilons of the path integral. It's a very crude tool. It doesn't play nicely with gauge invariants. Rostin and Morris have given a kind of an existence proof for a gauge invariant continuum cutoff, but it doesn't play nicely with gauge invariants, certainly not with coordinate invariants, not with extended supersymmetry, certainly not with duality. There should be a better way to think about quantum field theory in a completely different or partly different language. I'll mention one sort of thing. So when you think about the Wilsonian RG, here's energy, here's the cutoff, and you usually think about integrating out all the high energy stuff and just having fields here. So Akane Hamada and Moriyama some years back did something kind of cute. I think they were the first to do it. They considered a Wilson RG where you did something different. You didn't integrate everything out. You had an n=4 theory up here, and you had n=1 theory. They wanted to study the RG in the n=1 theory, but they used the n=4 theory as a Wilsonian sort of regulator. So what's happening here is you're sort of assuming that there is some wonderful quantum field theory that sort of has some other definition. And once you have this, you can use this to build everything else. And this certainly is a lot of the flavor of what's going on. Maybe there's an even more wonderful quantum field theory in six dimensions. I don't know where the most wonderful one is. But you know, this certainly is a lot of the flavor of what's going on in your program. So, I mean, I think you're quite far from answering this question. But the question I like to ask myself when I hear these talks is, at some point, will it be possible to use this to actually give it a definition of the theory? And really, I mean, as complete as the Wilsonian one does. You know, the Wilsonian description, crude as it is, you know, defines any correlator, defines any observable, and so defines it even on a curved space-time. And so, you know, this it would be, if there were some alternate way to construct some special quantum field theories with the same level of completeness, then that might be a better way to think about things. Okay, so I have one last sort of a slightly different perspective on the questions I've been talking about. So there's this notion of precursors, which is the following. Here's the boundary of ADS again. Suppose we have some excitation, not on the boundary, but it's in the interior, you know, traveling in some direction. How do we characterize it? How do we see this in terms of observables in the conformal field theory at the same time? Here's one way to do it. We know that if we act with local operators at the boundary, then it'll create a particle which will propagate into the interior. And basically, we can create any state we want in this way by acting with appropriate particles. And so this is how we could have created it in the past. And then if we sort of integrate this forward in time, there is some image of this operator, what it evolves to in time, and whatever this operator is, creates or destroys or detects that particle. And these operators are called precursors, and I think where the name comes from is actually the time reverse of this picture. So these are operators that let you, in the time reverse, this picture, this particle is coming towards the boundary, and these are operators that will let you know that it's coming before it gets there. Right, because local operators will only detect the particle when it gets to the boundary. These are operators that will tell you it's on its way. And what do they look like? Well, so you have some, again, something at the least, it's some like trace of F mu squared. And as time evolves, these are at a point, but as time evolves, these fields will propagate, so they'll move apart, and they'll interact. And so this will be some non-local operator. It'll be gauge invariant. And so there'll be some sense in which this operator is a Wilson loop or a sum over Wilson loops, just using the sort of assumption that every non-local gauge invariant operator is in some sense a sum over Wilson loops. And so it's been a long question to try to characterize these non-local operators. Now, I don't have anything to say about this right now. I think it's encouraging to think about the loop equations again, but to think about them in a slightly different way, in which they act as evolution equations in time. The normal loop derivative operator doesn't have it's a Laplacian, like it doesn't have a natural interpretation of the time derivative. Right? There should be some alternate formulation. It was inspiring. I think it was in David Skinner's talk. He was actually able to work with the loop equations, but that was in the Chern-Simons theory where they were nice in first order. And then the really awful thing about real gauge theories I have to understand how this trick was accomplished because. You know, once you have, you know, Maxwell gauge theories, the loop equations are second order in these loop derivatives, and they become rather intractable. So that's my hour, but if I could have 5 to 7 more minutes, I have one cute little thing about Wilson loops to mention. So we haven't gotten very far. This is work that's kind of just underway with with Jamie Sully. But we realized something cute about Wilson loops, which then we found out that Juan and Alday already knew, but they didn't do everything. So in ADS-CFT duality, it's natural to work with BPS loops. In which you have in which the loop operator couples to the vector potential and also to the scalars of the n=4 theory with equal strength. And what about though the ordinary gauge holonomy? That's a perfectly good observable in gauge theory. You know, shouldn't ADS-CFT be able to, if it's such a cool thing, be able to calculate this? And yes, actually, it can do it quite simply, and it's embarrassing how simple it is. So if we think about, we know of course that if you put this operator into the gauge theory, it means that there is some string world sheet ending on the Poincaré boundary, but also this world sheet has to be doing something on the 5-sphere, and its position on the 5-sphere is just this variable ui, and so these 5-sphere variables have for this operator Dirichlet boundary conditions. They're pinned down. Why not Neumann boundary conditions? In fact, Neumann boundary conditions give you this operator. And there's various ways you can think about this, from sort of getting to this from this by some averaging procedure or some limiting procedure. Let's just think about symmetries. So both of these are conformally covariant, meaning if you make a conformal transformation, they just, you know, all that happens is you change the curve. And that's a pretty special property. Trying to think. I want to say yes. You want David's nodding, so I'll say yes. I think so. Yeah. Also, this one obviously is not SO6 invariant. It breaks. It identifies a point on the 5-sphere like this. And this one is SO6 invariant, and so are the Neumann conditions. Though that pretty much uniquely determines this operator, because it's conformally covariant, meaning it's the exponential line integrals of dimension 1 operators. It's SO6 invariant, so that can't appear. What else is left? I'll just mention that you can also check the supersymmetry. And indeed, with Dirichlet boundary conditions, the world sheet theory is supersymmetric. With Neumann boundary conditions, all supersymmetries are broken at the boundary, as you'd expect for the dual operators. But there's a bit more to say, because what about when you have this operator, but with say ui less than, it could be greater than one, but yeah, less than one is simpler. What about something between the two? So, in general, you'd have at the boundary a linear combination. And so alpha equals 0 is Dirichlet, beta equals 0 is Neumann. But you could more generally have, say, alpha over beta. Rather than fixing one of them to 0, you could fix their ratio. And this is actually just another realization of something that comes up a lot in ADS-CFT, where you have two solutions, the normalizable and non-normalizable, and you can fix, in some range of dimensions, you can fix one or the other. And if you fix the ratio, there's an RG flow. If you fix the ratio, then near the boundary, it looks like alpha over beta is fixed. Near the boundary, this term dominates, and it looks like Neumann conditions. Near the interior, this term dominates, and it looks like Dirichlet conditions. And so if you start with this operator, but with a coefficient midway between the BPS and Wilson cases, it should flow from the Wilson and the UV to the BPS and the R. And that's a prediction that you can test at weak coupling. And indeed at weak coupling, you find partial mu of U squared is something like lambda over 4 pi. U squared minus u to the fourth. The u to the fourth terms are easy to get out. They're just graphs like this. That's a scalar loop and that's a scalar line. Indeed, it has exactly the property you'd expect from strong coupling, that it flows from u equals zero, the Wilson loop in the IR, to u equals one in the infrared. But there's still more, because once you start thinking about this observation seems to correct the mismatch between operators you can define in the CFT and operators you can define in ADS. But how about this operator? How about on the ADS side, if we take Dirichlet conditions on, say, three of these variables, just for example, but then Neumann conditions on these? That's neither of these operators. That's strong. In the ADS theory, this has different fluctuations, different determinants. So this is neither this operator, nor this operator, nor anything in between. What is it? Well, in fact, there seem to be more loop operators that you can define, more loop operators that you can define at strong coupling than at weak. And it's easy to see why this is. Because when you have this flow described by Witten between the two quantizations, in the IR stable quant, so suppose we have a Wilson line and we insert one power of the field of the scalar field. Then if you do that in the Dirichlet theory, the infrared theory, the dimension is one. If you do that in the UV theory, the Wilson theory, the dimension strong coupling is 1 minus 1, which is 0. At weak coupling, this is still 1, and this is like 1 minus lambda over 8 pi, 4 pi squared or 2 pi squared. But at strong coupling, it's 0. Because you have these dimension 0 operators, it means that you can, at strong coupling, you can define a lot more operators. You can put in here, instead of just things linear in U, you can put in any polynomial, any function of the U's. And there's an anomalous dimension, so there's an anomalous dimension here, so for any given lambda, you can't go too high in spin. But for large lambdas, a much larger set of loop-like operators that make sense.
You meant polynomial of phi, right?
Polynomial of phi. Most of them flow to the BPS operator. As long as if P has isolated minima, you just flow to the minimum, and you get the BPS operator there. But in fact, here's something that doesn't have an isolated minimum. Take this P to be phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared plus phi 3 squared minus the other three. Then you get something which flows to this operator I was describing here, where three of the coordinates are pinned down and three others flow freely. So at strong coupling, there's a richer spectrum of operators and a richer set of RP flows. And as you reduce lambda, more and more of these operators become non-normalizable. That is, once this dimension exceeds 1, it's not clear whether you can define the operator. Actually, maybe you can. But as you reduce the dimension, certainly the number of operators that you can define in a simple way becomes smaller and smaller. And when you get down to very weak coupling, you only have these two. And the ones that interpolate between them. So I don't know. I think this is cute. I don't know whether it's a deep thing, but it's kind of a necessary preliminary to understanding this question of defining and normalizing loop operators is a necessary preliminary to understanding the loop equations on both sides of the duality. So thank you.